Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are now listening to the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 19, hosted by myself, The Last Skeptic, as always, featuring special guests Dane Baptiste and Daniel Taylor, fresh from starring in a TV show that he wrote himself on ITV2, Time Waster. So make sure you go watch that immediately. It's fucking incredible. This podcast is sponsored by my brand new album, This Is Where It Gets Good, which is out right now on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, all that good shit. Make sure you go stream it, buy it, do whatever. Apologies in advance, the sound quality of this episode isn't fucking incredible. It's because my boy Seb, who usually records it for me, you know the one with the laugh, he wasn't around for the recording of this, so I did it all myself in some kind of mad haphazard way. So stick with it, it's still fucking amazing. Enjoy the show. Also, it's important to note that Daniel Taylor was part of a comedy duo called Ginger and Black with him and Eri, and that is who we mention later on, because we forgot to talk about the actual name of his comedy duo in the podcast because we were just having too much fun. So there you go. That's the background. Enjoy. You're now listening to the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 19. Damn. Featuring my very special guests, Dane and Daniel.
We say
You should have an audience, but now I wasn't going to do the like one hand clap thing.
I didn't want to clap for myself.
You can clap for the group.
More life, everybody.
Alright, so how are you guys? I haven't met you before, Dane, and I haven't seen you in fucking ages, yeah. Daniel. So there's a lot to catch up on. Let's start at the very top. Or I know that Dane wanted to talk to you about as well. I want to chat to you about Time Wasters, man.
Yeah,
it's fucking exciting.
So exciting, man. It's one of these things where you just like, you just spend your, I mean, I guess myself personally, it's like you spend your life with this idea and you think, I hope someone does something like this, or you want to see something like that, and then it happens, man. And it's one of those things where it's like you have it in informal chats and conversations about this whole idea, and it's like, it's just always been a great premise for a great joke. To say to someone to make it into something, take that concept, is like,
it's hugely inspiring.
It's been nice. Like, weirdly enough, speaking to so many people about it, that they've all said like a similar thing. I think that's where the idea kind of came from, just like a silly idea. And I never ever thought that I'd be able to make it, do you know what I mean? Ridiculous.
Yeah.
But in the end, I did it.
You did it, man. It's done, man. It's massively inspiring, and nice cast as well, man.
It's really good. Like, everyone in it, I think that's what I am most proud of. Like, when people talk about the show, they talk about the cast and how well we get on together, and it's like a nice group, and it's good, and everyone's so good. Like, everyone brought their A game as well. That made me a little bit scared as well.
How long did it take to film?
It took 6 weeks. Well, no, we did a pilot, which is episode one, and then we did, then we filmed another 5 up in Liverpool. It was good fun. It was one of the most fun jobs I've ever done. I think everyone was just quite enthusiastic about it, and I think that shows on screen, which is good.
No, definitely, I have very limited acting experience, but so, it's nice when you get involved in a project where, you know, like you said, it's almost kind of relaxed to know that you could potentially be the weak link. I was like the idea that, you know, everyone's bringing their A game and stuff, and it's always good. And I think when you do have a good idea, it's reflected. Like, you see, like, even the crew.
Yeah, I mean, everyone, like, there were so many crew members that it was their first job.
Oh, cool.
And other people would say to them, don't get too excited because this is not how all jobs are.
People can tell when they're working on something that's come from the heart, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
definitely.
If you've made it and it's something that you've always wanted to do and you've cast people that you really respect, then everyone's going to be able to tell that no one's there because they don't want to be there because it's a check. You know what I mean? They're there because they actually really want to be there.
I think especially like it's always like, it's a nice space where, because I imagine a lot of people that get involved, even from the crew side, they have creative aspirations. And then a lot of time, once you start getting involved in the industry, you have to kind of manage those. So if you get involved, especially with something that's a new and a novel concept, and then you get to like see other people are just excited about creating something very new, like it's probably rare you get to enjoy it.
Just seeing like the response from people as well and like... Just that similar thing of like people just excited to see black people on screen.
Exactly.
Every time I go into my barber's, I go to the barber's this morning. People were just excited. I'm like,
how did you do it?
Genuinely. How did you do a show about four black people and it's not about guns and drug deals and stuff like that? How did you do this show that is sci-fi? Do you know what I mean? It kind of blows people's minds because they just had no idea that black people could time travel. And it's hilarious when we do time travel. Do you know what I mean? And we also do all the other shit that white people do.
On the flip side of what was a really clever idea too, because it's a complete indictment of our times, that you've got a bunch of young people who don't want to actually be in our time. Actually, there's a better option. I'm not panicking about going back because it's shit there. So flip side of what that's not a bad shout. Shout at all.
It's a good point, man. That seems to be the zeitgeist of today, that everyone's trying to go backwards, man. If you look at like the States and making America great again as opposed to making it greater. Definitely there's definitely a need for nostalgia.
I had a question from Doc who he wanted to ask, because the original name of the show was Black to the Future.
It's a good name. No, Daniel, bank that.
I tell you, we went through every single name. And like, I sent out like WhatsApp messages to my friends, to email saying, please, can someone find a name?
Any honorable mention? Any other honorable mention names?
They were all like, Back to Black. Blackwood
is good as well.
Blackwood was around for a little bit. And then it went, like, honestly, we went through loads of them. And then my producer that came up with Time Wasters. And I hated it because I think I couldn't let go of Back to the Future. I couldn't. But eventually, like, everyone was saying how much they liked the new title. So I was like, you know what? That's wrong.
But now when I think about it, Time Wasters, I think it's a good title. I think it's in the vein of Ghostbusters. It translates a lot better. It's like, I'm thinking merchandise. I'm thinking fully articulated action figures.
That is the next stage.
It's so funny. Like, when you, I don't do it anymore. I only did it for the first episode. But, like, I went onto Twitter just to see what the general reaction was. And when you hashtag Time Wasters, you realize how many people use Time Wasters but not about my show. I'm sick and tired of dealing with these Time Wasters. It's been good. Like, it's the people, the response from it is that people have kind of enjoyed the journey as well, and like how the, you know, you have characters that kind of come and go, and like just the journey of each character, and it's like a full complete set and series, but then obviously potential to go further.
Yeah, exactly.
I made sure.
Of course.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Write some more.
Exactly. Actually, I think you've blagged a majority black cast period drama.
And there were so many comments from people, like trolls, were just like, and you talk about diversity, where's all the white people in it? And the hilarious thing is that even the show is about four black leads, everyone else in the world, in that world, is white.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean? Everyone else.
It's so ridiculous. I saw some of the trolls because I was just about to reply to people and I was like, no, I'm not going to do it.
However, not all cast members did.
No.
Like Samson, he plays Horace, he was like, your mum.
Ridiculous that people think that that's an actual line of criticism as well. Like, especially when it's the flip side, when you've got a show that people think is back in the day and there's a black cast member or an Asian cast member that, what are you talking about? This isn't realistic. Yeah. Like, yeah. Indians in the Second World War.
I remember I was at the Mobos and I remember a guy being like, oh, the Mobos? Well, if there was a award show of music of white origin, what would people say then? And I was, at first I was like, about to get into it, I thought, no, actually, no, I would love to see that.
Yeah.
I want to see that. I want to see the musical white origin awards. I want to see, like, yeah. And now the awards for Breakthrough Morris Dancer.
So, speaking of which, because obviously, Dane, like, you interact with a lot of people on Twitter as well, especially a lot of these dickheads that are trolls, and I see it in it. It makes me both laugh at their idiocy and also feel for you because you do interact with them.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your
a lot of people think it's very masochistic, but I practice a system of self-defense which I call troll judo.
Troll judo.
Yeah. And basically involves me engaging with these trolls using takedowns and blocks.
Blocks
with any kind of system, and it's just a lot of time I just feel like there is just a very culture, especially among trolls, whereby they say stuff like this or they spit kind of this vitriolic stuff, and normally they pick their targets, whether it's like, you might be like a young female creative in the spotlight and they'll attack there, or it's usually some racist trope. And for me, it's like, I'm aware that you can't necessarily win with, you won't win with these trolls, but I just want to engage the fact that, you know, you are somebody, because I know the mentality. Because the thing about trollism is that is an acute condition that everyone can kind of end up kind of succumbing to. So even though you can seem like a rational person, if you scroll down just a timeline of comments yourself, just the ignorance you see can cause you to become resentful of humanity. Just by, if you go on a YouTube clip, you start thinking, "Oh, people are idiots, like fucking," and you can feel yourself beginning to change yourself. So anyone can be guilty of trollism. So I just feel like, I just like to engage these people because A, it's good practice, because for them doing that, then if I'm doing live and I'm dealing with hecklers,
when the heckles
where they're live and I can see them and they don't have the veil of anonymity, they won't say the stuff that they can say online. Yeah. So I know that's basically where this supposed courage comes from. So I like to engage it, because for me it's just like, I don't know, man, I just like the psychological side of it, of kind of push buttons and just draw them out, because I feel like, in the same way that we've, especially over the last couple of years, we've lamented the whole thing about echo chambers and people kind of having their own bubbles, I like to engage this other side. And I just like to challenge that to the point where, like, I know who you really are, and I just want to kind of bring that out of them. So I like to bait them in that, because it won't take that long. Usually within 3 or 4 or 5 tweets, they'll reveal who they are anyway. And for me, I like to just demonstrate that. So for me, it's just, I don't know, it's sport for me. And also because, like, I just like the idea that it's just, I will always just remind them that this is what you're doing because you're afraid to be yourself. And I know there's a lot of people there who, like, I just can't engage trolls because they are so vitriolic and the things they say are so bad, but I'm like, I'm afraid, and I will remind these people all the time that in this exchange, while you feel you may have said something to me, we both know you're a coward. And I'll always continue to be like, who are you then? What's your name? Because my name is on Twitter, so I'm not hiding who I am, and I'm in the public eye. So when you're challenging me, I know you're a coward. So that's what it is, man. I've just grown up on too many fucking comic books.
I love it though.
So I'm like Batman. It's like, I know that.
I'm not saying I'm
Batman, but you know, I have this obsession to, like, I know that most people, like, it's not worth engaging these people, but I'm like, I'm prepared to go in the dirt. And I'll find these trolls.
Someone has to.
I think so, someone has to. But it generally is, for a large part of it, for me, it's a sport. But I just think it's just to engage these people because, you know, on both, like, because now we have a point where we've, like, people feel that the liberal narrative has become so myopic and it's like that it doesn't entertain anything else. And now liberalism is now just a question of just suppressing anything that doesn't agree with that voice.
Right.
Now, for me, I feel like this—the word liberal has kind of been perverted to push this
conservative agenda. I was going to say that because I don't even understand what it even means anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I studied sociology, and I always thought, oh, maybe I'm a liberal, but I'm a liberal person. I think that. But I'm like, now people see people call themselves liberals, and I'm like, that isn't
that's
me.
Not, that's not you. Yeah, exactly.
No, that's not me.
Yeah. So some people. So I guess that. So even that. I suppose that narrative, and in the same way, like, you know, argue most ideologies like feminism have kind of been hijacked to an extent where people can just give a... It's very hard for you to explain an ideology in the space of 140 characters anyway.
Yeah.
So the fact that everyone endeavours to do so is already kind of counterproductive.
But we have got 280 now.
So now we've got 280, yeah. So now we can, exactly. And then what's happened as a result of that is that now... Supposedly, that's given credence to this rise of what we call alt-right, where they're like, because liberals have become so myopic and they've pushed their agenda so hard that being conservative or right-wing and then alt-right is considered punk. But to me, it's not punk. That's you're just ignorant. It's not, and they're always lamenting that political correctness. But for me, it's like, then why call yourself the alt-right then?
Because
what the alternative to right is left, so you can't be alt-right. So for me, if how can you complain about political correctness? The new thing now for like a lot of trolls is that. They don't want to be called racists when they are racist.
Yeah.
And I've had a back and forth with a guy who's like, you're being racist. You're making generalisations about white people. But that's the point. Like, if you don't see the irony of that, you're like, well, how can you make generalisations? That's the cornerstone of... And this is a guy that's following Katie Hopkins and he's following Nigel Farage. But then... So I feel like a lot of the time, there's a lot of people in public eye who don't really have the facility to challenge these kind of people. Yeah. But obviously, my line of work is kind of based on me having discourse and it's a kind of discursive medium that I work in. So... I'm prepared to challenge these people anyway, and I guess, you know, I have to. I'm vocal because it's my job, and so, but I want to prove that I can challenge these people, like because I just consider it to be heckles.
Yeah.
So for me, it's just heckle, it's me practicing heckle put down. Yeah. So literally, it's just sparring, and and my manager, she's been like, just stop doing this. Stop doing it.
I can imagine.
But I feel like you know that's just a part of the artistry's, man. Is that I stand like I don't just say this stuff on stage to like you know curry favor with my audience. Like I believe in what I'm saying.
Is that why they tell you not to do it?
Like, well, I think they just tell me to do it because they just think because if like potential like stakeholders like producers and stuff look through my timeline, they see me having back and forth with like racists and stuff, they just be like put off and stuff like that. So I do get when they say that, and at some point I will mute and I have to block people at some point, but fuck that turn of a cheek, man. I'll fuck you, man. that's my position, man, because I just look at it like this, like people a lot of time we tend to conflate our evolution with technological advance, and it's not the same. Like human beings are still human beings, and they and you know again, and things like Twitter go to show you now that when we used to watch like you know historical depictions of people being in stocks or people being hung or public executions, and you think what kind of barbarian would go and watch someone get hung that you don't know? Well, now the proof is now in the trolls, and that we've not really evolved that much now. That people now will come and they'll cry out, and you know they'll see deplorable acts taking place on you know in on the news, because that's a lot of time some social networks are people's hubs for news now. And now you see these people who are like, you know, they're even attention seeking, or like, you know, they're trying to, or like, you know, people like Katie Hopkins who exist as voice pieces, and they're like, they're, it's almost like it's like morality porn, and she realizes that there's a business model from saying this stuff, because the Tut Tut Brigade will be like, oh, I can't believe she said that, but and then but they'll be like, well, someone had to say it. But, but and for me, and so as far as
I'm concerned, correct has gone mad.
But then for me, what does that even fucking mean?
It means nothing.
Doesn't mean anything.
It's nonsense.
When a lot of time, when and people that say that or talk about political correctness, what they mean is that I want to be able to act without consequence. That is not how the world works, as far as I'm concerned, and this is. Things that people were like, well, you can't say something. No, you can't say something, because if you said something to someone like that, and we were talking in real life, and I punched in your face, you're gonna call the police before me.
Yeah,
and you're gonna remember that you are like a little bitch at a desk, and then you're gonna call the police. and for me, that's what it is. What I'm doing by engaging on social networks is really saying that, you know, if we remove this veil of social networks and you being able to hide behind digital anonymity, there is no way you'd say stuff like this in real life. And what I try to remind people on stage and stuff as well is that. Even because this stuff can affect, especially people who don't have a certain level of resonance, this affects them, and this can affect people. And you know, this is this kind of like narrative that contributes to people's body dysmorphia or you know, giving people a complex. But historically, if you read something like that, you were taking a shit in a public toilet and you saw a swastika on the wall, you'd be like, who sits down surrounded by other people's fecal matter to write that down? Like, who's got time to do that shit? Or like, when you're in school and you're at a desk and you see someone's written something, you're like, well. Obviously, you failed because that's you got time to do this.
And I
make a point sometimes where people are like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, why aren't you at work? It's like, it's 3 o'clock, it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. what are you doing?
It's filled with hatred.
Just what you're doing, it's filled with hatred. So that's what I mean. I like to get out because. It's just that we just live in a time where because social media is so prevalent, we give it a lot of credence. Social networking has not been around for that long for us to work out how it affects human psychology. But it's just a lot of the time these people like they people take advantage of this stuff, and a lot of people they become very you know they get a lot of they take on this new persona. And
yeah,
I, for me, it's always like, but who are you really?
Yeah. And do you, Danny, do you ever interact? Because I know you're saying some of your castmates do sometimes respond, but like, do you ever like feel baited out?
No, I mean, the thing I love about your tweets is that they're perfect. They're spot on. But no, I tend not to. I just I avoid it. I'm just a civilian.
Just a civilian.
I think it's a good idea sometimes to avoid it, because you know, especially because again, like even me, I have to kind of rationalize my behavior sometimes. I think like I've never been like sitting down like in a pub and being like, I can't believe Nazi 75 said that shit to me. It's not going to come back. But at the same time, I kind of been thinking about it, like you know, celebrities have always had like security detail being these enormous guys. Mm. After a while, like your celebrity detail is going to be like these nerds being like sexually online and stuff. And I always think that. Like in my perfect world, if I did have like my online security, then it'd be like I would always just, if someone engages me, I'd just find their IP address.
Oh man, I mean, do you, Danny, ever feel like you have to speak a certain way online, or is there any pressures that you find like in order to not upset people, especially the business side of things?
I just use it as entertainment and just a bit of fun and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now I just enjoy reading. Like I enjoy doing things. Like that's my excitement.
Since the show, have you been getting hit up by different kinds of people about doing, you know, either writing or acting or even doing the panel shows or doing, you know, whatever it is?
Yeah, there's been quite a few, like different bits and bobs, but this, because it was such a quick turnaround, so I'm already talking, even though it's not being recommissioned, I'm already talking about doing a series 2. Like, my production company is quite confident about it, so I've already kind of been put to work. It might be pointless. I might end up with all these scripts and like nowhere to film it. It'd just be me and my iPhone. But like, I'm just kind of waiting to hear if something happens. So I've kind of stepped out of it. I worked on a few other shows between once I finished editing and we put it on screen. I worked on a few other shows just as a writer for a couple of Netflix shows, and then
casually drop it in,
just chuck those in. And then now I'm back into it, so but I'm hoping like once I've done this and then done some once I've done series 2, if I get series 2, I'm hoping to kind of get back into acting, because I kind of I miss that. I miss like just turning up and doing someone else's lines.
And do you miss stand up?
Yes and no. So I still see Eri. So we still do our musical double act thing, but we've not done it for 3 years now.
Wow.
And we just wanted to branch out and do different things.
Yeah.
So we wanted to do a bit more acting, a bit more writing, and also not only that as well, but I think when you do stand up, you can't do it half heartedly. I think you feel like you have to, because you get a bit stagnant. Because I don't know about you, Dave, but like the next goal is to like go to different places and then to do bigger.
That's kind of the stage I'm at now. I guess it's the first thing is that you're proving you're funny, and then I've been able to do that for a long time, and then it's being able to present a comedic slant on a topic and like I said, then it's just, you know, how can I make this voice translate, you know, globally? That's your endeavour to do. So,
and we were in that halfway stage, because we were like spreading ourselves really thin doing other things, and we just kind of realised that the stand up, we kind of put a few blocks back. But yeah, maybe one day stand up might come back. And acting, like, obviously you've got people on set laughing whilst you're doing the scene and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's very starting stuff here, and they're also on side from the very get-go, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
going into a room. You've got to prove yourself.
Mm.
And so when you do that, it just makes you feel good inside, because you're like, well, I've gone away, I've written this, I've made you laugh, I've entertained you with what's come out of my head.
Yeah. It's different from having your, you know, like, long trailer. What was the catering like then?
That was actually your point. I can't remember the company, and I feel bad for not remembering, because there was the loveliest guys as well. But that food was
good.
Was, yeah, they took care of it.
What kind of food?
On the last day they made lamb shank.
I asked Asim and Sipa Grinder as well about the People Just Do Nothing catering. Mm-hmm. I ask every person, like Ed Skrine when he's on, I say, what was the last film's catering? Like, I have to know, because, you know, the only reason I ever visit my friends on set is for the catering.
Oh, of course.
There's no other reason. Yeah. Like, sure, it's cool. It's sure it's great. Yeah, I get to meet some nice people. But the only reason I'm there, like, sometimes I only just show up at lunchtime.
Yeah.
Because you have to.
Why on earth would you want to be there for any of the filming day?
Because there's just no point.
Filming is, it's actually quite boring.
Yes.
I've learned that from doing a pilot is that basically an actor's life is just sitting around waiting to eat and then waiting to do lines.
Yeah. And then when it comes time to doing lines, like even when you're on set, most of it is not actually you doing lines. It's people setting up cameras and setting up lights.
Yeah.
And making sure your hair is good and your clothes are good and whatnot. And then they'll go action and then you act for about 10, 15 seconds.
Yeah. That's
then you stop again. And then you wait for another 45 minutes and then you do it again. Like, it's the most bitty thing.
Yeah. But how is that? Like, I always think it must be so difficult to get in the vibe, like to get in the zone. Like, how do you, I always think when I see people crying or like having to be really emotional, but how can they do, it's a great skill, because how can you do that on demand and then go, cool, some more makeup, cool.
But how can you take that skill though? Like, I remember seeing an outtake from Breaking Bad, and it was just a bit, spoiler alert, just a bit as Jesse's girlfriend dies, she ODs.
So she ODs. That's Kristen Ritter's character. She was in it far, like, too short. She's
amazing. She was brilliant, What's that actor's name again? Brian Cranston's character.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Comes in and then starts talking to Aaron Paul and, like, talking to him, and he's like crying as he's talking to him, and then he fucks up a line, and then he's just like, oh shit, sorry, that's not the line, is it? Sorry, let's go again, and go straight into it and starts bawling again.
That's I'm crazy.
Like, how? Like, for me, like, as a comedy actor, it's fine because you piss about until someone says action, and then you just piss about, right, but with the lines that are on paper.
Exactly.
And then they cut, and then you piss about. So it's relatively, it's not too difficult, and that's why it's odd, because when you actually think about filming, it seems like a very shit process. But because if you're enjoying the times in between, then doing the stuff on set is also quite fun as well. But how people do dramas and are bawling on set, like Olivia Colman, everything she's in, she's always bawling. I don't know how she gets through doing it, but she's an incredible actress because she does it, and she's always on point, and she's and when I've heard stories about her off set, like, apparently she doesn't really learn her lines, she just kind of roughly knows them and then gets them set, and then she's just so talented that she can just go bam, and then here comes the tears, here comes the lines, cut, cool, she's laughing, joking, I've got some more.
I guess, and that's why I guess they get a lot of credit for, like, when especially when comedic actors make the transition into more dramatic roles. So obviously Bryan Cranston was doing Malcolm in the Middle for so many years and did it so well,
the classics,
exactly,
Shakespearean Malcolm in the Middle.
It was a great show, but for him to go from that to, like, you know, to Walter White,
I love those funny theories that talk about how Malcolm in the Middle is just based after Breaking Bad, and so he has to go into witness protection, and he
becomes
in a family, like, sick,
so good. Yeah, so good, man.
But how did you find it on Sunny D?
I find it similar, because it was my
fucking
first
hilarious,
it was my first foray into acting and stuff, man. But it was like, I just had the benefit of having some great people that were because my sisters played Bemi Ikemelo and David Ajayo, they're from the Royal Shakespeare Company, so they're theatrically trained, but I had, like, some limited TV experience, but they kind of slot into it very easily. And Sasha as well, like, Sasha she'd done dramatic acting more than comedy, so for her she was making the transition in the opposite way. But and then having Don Warrington, having, like, a powerhouse as well, but so, like, so far as a foundation for competence, it was quite easy to, like, just do my lines, and because they're comedic and I'm just playing a heightened version of self, the task wasn't that hard for me to, like, to do it. But then it was just those guys kind of brought out more in me and stuff as well, so I just was able to be a lot more expressive. But obviously it was a new project and had quite limited budget, being done by the BBC, but just speaking with the crew and stuff, it was just like I said, people who had a lot of creative talent, and I just basically made a point of principle to be like, if you've got an idea and you can make it happen with the resources we have, then I'm more than prepared to entertain that. Like, I wasn't too precious about script. So especially with someone like Catherine Ryan, who has, you know, arguably a lot more, well, has more comedy experience both on stage than I have, and TV experience. So a lot of time those parts, I was like, just riff. And and she just said, so there's parts like when I'm playing football and she's saying all this stuff, and that's all her. And for me, so I just look over. So when I say the makeup girls all pissing themselves, and that's staying in, because
exactly.
I know it's organic and I know it works.
So is TV on your agenda, like to return to it, to do something else?
Do you know what, like, I think it would have been initially, but I feel like now, where, like, obviously, I guess I'm following the formula of having, you know, if you're having like 6x30 episodes, or like 4x30, I did 4, like, or like 6x22-minute episodes, like, I kind of tried to push this in Sunny D's and it was a bit more difficult, but like, I wouldn't want to be restricted to like that kind of paradigm for making a sitcom. Mm-hmm. So even if I did like a piece that was like maybe 40 minutes long, dealing with a particular topic, and it was like, you know, in the same way that, you know, you can do an EP or you can do like a mixtape, and it can vary in length, and doesn't always have to be like an LP. So especially now we're seeing where you've seen the rise of like Instagram comics, and obviously Michael Dapper is pretty much global now. Like, I'm here, even I was in Australia and people are saying stuff like, you know, 2 plus 2s. And that's what I mean, and people do, and it's like adults saying like quick maths and stuff, and kids love this shit, and you know, so it's just
he's now the most streamed UK rapper. He's the most popular UK rapper. I can't be mad. Like, and there's no one who I've spoken to within the scene who is mad at that. Everyone's just really happy. Like,
He
seems like a safe dude. He seems like he's making jokes, but I always think it's a great signifier of a healthy scene once you start getting parody records.
Of course, exactly.
Your scene is not big enough if there's not people taking the piss out of it.
And also, like, you know, the send up kind of works artistically, because it means if you're lending to that kind of archetype, then maybe you need to look at your acts and stuff. Because, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know more than anybody else, like, for a lot of like road rap or trap rap or drill rap, like, a lot of time it becomes indistinguishable.
Even
like Afrobeats has been able to make that transition to mainstream, but now, like, you get a lot of Afrobeat artists, or even though you're necessarily cool with it, it's Afrobeat, but it's, for me, it almost sounds like it's like UK rap, but it's like with auto-tune. And it's like, you know, there's like, I like someone like Jay Huss, but then I see like and you got like Kojo Funds and then Notes and stuff, and then you see loads and loads of clones and stuff. So it's sometimes that kind of thing, that screen is good. Like you said, it's big enough that you're being parodied, it's a good sign. And you know, I kind of make stuff, I like to think I'd make something that, even if it doesn't necessarily have, you know, an ubiquitous appeal now, like, I feel as people move on, in the same way that when I first watched The Simpsons when I was a kid, I loved the fact that it was just an animated adult cartoon. Now, as I've gotten older, the reference, because I've taken in other art and other popular culture, I go back to The Simpsons and I see the reference.
There's references to, like, really, I listen to this podcast called, what is it, Stuff You Should Know or something like that, like, and it's, they did 2 episodes on The Simpsons. They started like fully going deep into like facts about it, and they were talking about some episodes that like direct pastiches and takes on like films from the 40s.
And they do it really well. And that's what I mean, like,
it's so smart.
It's so smart. Like, for me, I would say The Simpsons is probably, I feel, is probably one of the best studies of Americana that exist. And the reason why, and there was a point when obviously The Simpsons kind of had a dip, and it's because it got to a point where, like I said, after so many pastiches and so many homages, like, it got to the point where The Simpsons are now one of the longest running TV shows in history. So you run out of source material, so they've had to come up with original content, because really, more than anything, now people are kind of trying to follow them. But it's so far as like the archetypes in The Simpsons and how relevant it is to Americana, I think it's just amazing. And it's been massively influential to me, and I heard that kind of reflected in Sunny D. But
what's your favourite episode of The Simpsons?
Oh, that's a good one. I'd probably, off the top of my head, because there's probably more than one, but some of my favourite ones is like when Homer becomes a boxer. That's so funny. Itchy and Scratchy Land.
That's a good
one as well. And
a lot of people like Marge Against the Monorail. That one.
That's a really classic.
My favourite is the one where is it, where he does peyote and there's a talking dog.
That's a good one.
And the best thing about that that still cracks me up to this day, I must have first watched it when I was like 12 or something, still like this many years later, was when he comes out, he has the talking dog following him around and like giving him advice on stuff. And he comes back to reality and he's trying to fix stuff with Marge. And he's going like, you know, please help me. Give me the advice again. Like, tell me something. And he asks it a question. And the dog thought bubble comes up and he goes, Homer, I'm only a memory. I cannot provide any new information. That is a perfect time to take the piss break. And then we'll come back for the second half with a health shot. Done. Welcome back to part two of the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 19. And we've had the piss break, and now it's the tradition. But as it's a daytime, we won't be doing a boozy shot as usual. So I've made a really healthy shot filled with lemon, ginger, turmeric, cayenne pepper. And someone told me recently that in order to activate turmeric for all the health goodness, you have to put black pepper in it. So I put a bit of black pepper in it as well. And I like the irony that I'm saying, talking about a health shop whilst smoking at the same time. So it kind of cancels each other out.
Balance.
Let's all take this health shot.
Yeah.
Cheers. Thank you very
cheers.
Much.
Cheers.
Thank
you.
Cheers.
Tastes pretty damn good. Does anyone want a real?
Okay.
Yeah, but it's got a kick.
Yeah.
I like that.
It'll be good for my cold as well. So
I filtered out all the gunk. Like all the, you know, the ginger nonsense.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Because I've had that before. I've done this daytime one. We've all had a shot and everyone's there just picking shit up.
It's nice. It's all like afternoon tea.
Yeah,
it's
very civilized.
So we touched on a little bit about panel shows earlier, but you've done them before, of course.
Yeah, I've done a few, yeah.
And how do you find them? Like, what's your experience of them?
They've been good, man. The first one I did was Sweat the Small Stuff, and I was on with Russell Kane, Ramesh Ranganathan was on, and then we had super fun. And then I had Melvin Odum and Rochelle from the Saturdays.
Mm.
And it was fun, man. And it's just learning a new type of comedy timing, where normally I guess people are just waiting for the punchline, and it's more one directional. But here, it's learning to just bounce off other people and just kind of just manage your timing really. And then once you learn that, it's pretty fun to do and stuff. And I've done them with like 8 out of 10 cats with like Jimmy Carr and stuff as well. So
what was your experience of like 8 out of 10 cats? Like what's that like?
Yeah, it was fun, man. It's a bit more prep because it's a lot more topical and there's a lot more focus on it being topical.
Mm.
So it's not always as easy where you can maybe cite previous material or relevant material for stuff. So
yeah,
you have to kind of
you have to be ready with.
You have to be a bit ready, with bars. A few with more quips, and have your bars, Have to go there with a war chest and stuff as well. Yeah. But every now and again, someone might say something and it might stumble onto some stuff you might have before, and it's really good for you to get into and riff on it. But yeah, I've had the advantage in a lot of the stuff I've done. I've worked with like other comedy acts and stuff as well, and they've always provided an environment for you to like leave it open for you to get a bit out there and get it across and stuff as well. And I think that's probably the hardest part most people find with panel shows is like it's find the right time to slot in your material or be able to bounce. And so it's a lot of people that are prepared to help you with the timing and stuff. So I think most recently I did it was Cats again. I did it and Rob Beckett and Ashley and B were the captains and stuff as well. And
because
they're amazing, and because they're so so supportive, it makes it a real nice environment. So for the most part they've been cool. The hardest one I think when I did Mock the Week, it was in the week after the Orlando shootings.
Oh, shit.
So it's a hard week to mock.
Yeah.
So it's basically just finding other topics to kind of move around that. And then what happened was after we recorded it, then unfortunately like Joe Cox was killed.
Mm.
I say killed, I should say assassinated.
Assassinated, so it's a
political assassination of which we don't really hear much about.
Not exactly. It's so weird that we don't hear anything about that.
And for me, again, it's like, I remember speaking in my second Edinburgh show, talking about the fact that how often do you see like a white working class woman or a girl being elevated for something positive?
Yeah.
Not now we have a time where, you know, you've got your Love Islands and, you know, you've almost got like your kind of reality circuit where it's like your Love Island or your ex on the beach and then and you know, your whichever shore or whichever region it is. And yeah, and it's always kind of the same kind of trope, whereas, you know, this is somebody that was championing, you know, women's rights, and someone that was championing like immigrant rights and stuff and working class rights, and you know, she was assassinated, and it took for her assassination for us to kind of really be aware of her.
Yeah. Mm.
And she was championing the working class, you know, and in the north as well, where, you know, there's a really large divide both politically and economically, and it was just nuts. We only found out about it then, but it meant that they had to postpone that particular episode. So yeah, that kind of makes it difficult where, you know, it's always the too soon issue when we're dealing with, like, with news and, like, you know, topical.
It is difficult. I mean, there's, I read an article yesterday from my friend Hannah Flint. She's an amazing journalist. She wrote an article on Yahoo about how the Oscars this year is going to be very difficult.
Yeah,
it's going to be really difficult to do.
Oh yeah,
God, it's going to be super awkward.
Oh God,
as well.
Yeah.
But I'm intrigued to see how it's going to pan out, and to see what with Weinstein and everything, how, and with are all of the people who, I'll be careful with my words, who've had allegations and against them, are they going to show up?
That's a good point, man. I think, yeah, in general, like, these award shows are going to be outcoming under a lot more scrutiny than they have been. So,
yeah.
And we all thought Oscar so white was the issue.
I think it's a really important time for it, for men assessing, for men questioning.
Yeah, and it should, and it should, and it should.
It's great.
And I think it's great. From myself personally, like, I probably have, I've definitely exhibited male privilege. And sometimes when you're exhibiting privilege, it doesn't come from a place where you're, you know, apathetic to a cause, but it's like, my whole thing was, well, I would never disrespect women because I work with them every day, so why would anybody presume to do that? And then when I started doing comedy, then I realised that there was this real, you know, undercurrent of massive misogyny in comedy, and I wasn't really that aware of it, especially because from the outside, when I used to watch comedy, if I watched, like, you know, French and Saunders, or I was watching, like, you know, Queen Latifah and Living Single in the States, or you know, and I was seeing a female comic, as I was not even aware there was a gender distinction with comics. Like, even the feminine denomination of, like, saying comedienne, I wasn't even aware that people did that. Because when I grew up and I watched Channel 4, like, Roseanne Barr was one of the biggest shows on there. Ellen DeGeneres had a show, Brett Butler had a show, Margaret Cho had a show, you know, and then Nickelodeon, like, Sister Sister was a sitcom I watched, Moesha was a sitcom I watched, Alex Mack. So it was amazing. So for me, seeing comedy shows or seeing, like, a female protagonist, you know, or even the fact that, you know, you had, like, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, like, Aunt Vivian had a pivotal role a lot of the time and stuff, so it never occurred to me that this kind of misogyny existed. So now that I'm doing comedy, I get to hear a live account from, you know, the female experience, and now I hear guys now on stage, like, say, "Oh, I'm a feminist," and I feel like that's something I stay away from, because whoever you say you are or however you postulate, especially in comedy, that will permeate in your material anyway, and the more you're performing, the more people build in the context for who you are anyway. So you don't necessarily have to make these declarations. And then also at the same time, one of the reasons I try not to be like, oh, I'm a feminist, because I guess in a way, feminism comes under the umbrella term for humanism, as it should, because obviously women are the highest population of human beings on the planet. And also it's like, I don't want to be like, that's what I have to explain. So, like, I remember it's like when Malcolm X was saying that, if you're not a black person and you support these things, it's good to do that, but what's more important is that you don't need to convince us. It's the circles that you may come from which are more reticent to that you need to address. So in the same way, for me, it's like, there's no point in me saying to women, yeah, I stand with you, blah, blah. They can do that themselves. It's more important for me to disseminate this viewpoint to other men. So that's why it's more about me kind of pointing stuff which I think is maybe subversively feminist, as opposed to having to be like, I'm a feminist because blah blah, discussing it in a way. And sometimes I see people switch off, and you know, so those are people I have to engage a lot more. So it's like I said, it's a good time for men to fucking pay attention now, especially and really it's the age of Aquarius as well. That's the thing, like, I watch, like, Zeitgeist and shit, like, so we're now moving into, like, this new phase, like, I guess astrologically, where you know, the feminine is supposed to be a lot more prevalent. So really, especially the feminine part of the hemisphere is where we get creativity from as artists. So I'm entertaining that a lot more. And like I said, this is now a time to learn. And really, there's a lot of people that are like, "Oh, it's a loss of masculinity." That's down to you. If you feel down to you. If you feel that your masculinity suffers because women are realizing the voice, then that's maybe you're not that masculine. Maybe you've just been a conformist, or you've been in maybe enjoying this heterosexual male or cisgender privilege. And really, you should take them more of the time to learn as well.
I just want to, like, again, it's what we were saying earlier, but about these people talking about, oh, well, what about white people? It's those same people that then go, what about men? Like, what about men? Why is there all this stuff for women? Like,
yeah,
what about
men? Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it's the same thing.
I don't understand. When you were doing stand-up with Airy, as the duo, did you find any differences in the way that she was being treated as a comedian as opposed to you?
Yeah, definitely. And what's odd as well, like, Airy did say, like, it definitely made it in some ways easier by having like a male comedian with her, because she did some stand up by herself as well. Yeah. But also as well is that some of the things that would be encountered where she would she'd highlight the fact that people would always just assume that I wrote the material and like right. I'd do the gigs and the money and like everything was always like directly.
So crazy.
Yeah,
so crazy.
Why which is odd because as like a black male, like if I was working with a white male, then they wouldn't be directed to him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Eric used to go through all of these things all the time, and it was annoying. And it's a similar thing. Yeah, like yeah. I never ever, like growing up, I never ever made, because I watched Sister Emotion and all of those things.
Yeah.
And like and all the women in my family were just like they were at the top. Do you
Exactly. Yeah, it's essentially like a matriarchal culture.
Oh,
really.
Definitely.
Because I mean, that's what I always say. Because I start off doing the black or urban circuit. You go and tell one of those black female comedians we've got a quota and you can't. Go,
yeah.
You get slapped in the face. So I'll slap you in the face.
Yeah.
You feel lucky you get slapped in the face. So it was just weird to see that moving from that transition to mainstream and yeah man, it's kind of been disheartening like when you hear all these stories and stuff and you think, oh, how oblivious was I to this stuff, man? And like you know,
and it's like sitting down and going through them. So you know Nat, she like some of the stories that she was in this, so obviously all this kind of Weinstein stuff came out and then she's
not like similar to so people know.
Yeah, sorry. So she was like talking about like all the, so when the Weinstein came out, she was talking about like there was like a group who kind of started to out some of the male comedians in which were doing exactly what Weinstein was doing, and all the loads of male promoters and stuff like that. And some of the stories that she was telling me blew my mind. It just absolutely blew my mind. And the reason it blew my mind is because I'd never been in those situations. Situations where she'd be somewhere and like they'd all be given like hotel rooms, and the men would be given hotel rooms, and then the promoter was like, no, just stay in my house. And they'd be like, I don't want to stay in your house. Talking to other male comedians and going, do you mind if I take your room? Typical male comedian going, oh no, well, I shouldn't say typical, but not actually reading the situation and going, oh no, I don't want to stay in his house. I want a room for myself. It's fine, you stay there. Not quite getting the hint that she's trying to make is like, I'm a woman.
Which is dumb that they wouldn't pick up on it. And for me, this is again annoying thing, especially about comedy, is that where the meritocracy is supposed to come from how keen our observations are. So more than anybody else, we're supposed to see this shit. How are observational comedians missing this shit? Of all people, we should see this more than everybody else.
But when the whole thing came out, it didn't surprise me in the slightest. Like, you know, there's a lot of actors, American actors, that I'd heard stories about that had come out, you know, the Kevin Spacey thing, you know. If you're in the circuit of even music, TV, film, comedy,
you've heard
stories about Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, but then again, people never got listened to when they heard these stories about him or anyone else, you know. And that's why it's so good that it's reached a tipping point that people are actually listening about it now, which is fucking incredible. But you know what you said, Danny, about the, you know, Nat coming out and saying and other comedians coming out is, you know, I wasn't aware of that. I hadn't even seen that, so that's, you know,
I mean, it can only be a good thing. It can only be a good thing. And it was just and also it was like a wake-up call for me as well, because there's so much stuff that I mean, I saw some of it because it would happen to Airy, so I'd see some of it, but some of it that happened to Airy I didn't see, or like not necessarily I always understood, because sometimes I would do that typical male thing in my head. I'd never ever say it. In my head I'd be like, oh, is it because she's a woman? And the only reason I would never say it is because that's what people do to me when I say about black. Like, I'll say, this person is treating me differently because I'm black. And people are like, oh, but it's this weird thing that you do yourself. You start to question people or doubt people if it's not overt, unless someone's gone, you're black, you're a woman, like you tend to question it and so on and so forth. But I think
because people make you feel like it's paranoia.
Yeah. I think that's what that's.
And also the thing that grates me the most is when people say you're playing the race card.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Like,
who
just,
the fuck are you?
I see people say that to whoever online or whatever, and like. It makes me feel sick, man.
Yeah, I've got.
What is the race card?
Yeah, it's a race card. But the thing, I did my show this year where I addressed it, where it's very like it's interesting, like that turn of phrase of like race card and this idea that like it's like Magic the Gathering where you can like trump each other and it's like, you know, Dane opens with African American male and Daniel counters with you know, with a Somalian, and then Dane counters with a Southern Sudanese woman, Romany Gypsy. it's Pokemon.
And so Trump.
So it's funny. Like that. I think that'd be a good idea for like a sketch, man. But that's the thing. Is that, you know, again, that's another example. That's the kind of thing. That is the stuff when I will get trolls for that. Like, because the race card is, because that happens when that happens enough. Then the disaffected people start thinking, well, maybe there is a race card and blah blah. Not the question of, well, like what system has been in place historically that would necessitate a race card.
Yeah.
You know, especially when carte blanche means do whatever you want, and that means white card. So it's a very interesting turn of phrase to say that. Talking about all these cards and this kind of shit, man. You know,
a lot of it. I didn't even know that.
Card. Yeah. It means white card. Yeah. So
wow.
That's, you know,
crazy.
That's the thing. There's a lot of coding in this language when we talk about stuff like, you know, like things like race card, or even, you know, and there's even the old stuff like, you know, like black magic and all this kind of thing. And it all leads on to another thing where, like, I think a large part of when you're combating like these different facets of oppression is that it's how it's affected like the people, like especially and I think for a lot of outspoken feminists, that is what they're up against, is that some women have been so kind of inculcated into this chauvinistic idea of what place women should have, is that if another woman talks against, like, well, I want to have children, I want to be at home and cook, that's doesn't mean you make you any less than a feminist. The idea is about the choices that your gender doesn't predispose what you're entitled to in this world, and that's about as rudimentary as a standard you can make it for people to understand, is that there's no wrong way of being a feminist, and, you know, and embracing your womanhood, but it just means that you're not subject to archetypes that are dictated to you by a patriarchy. And again, for me, that might not be, and for me, I'm well aware that that is not necessarily the entire, you know, that's not the entirety of feminism, but that's a part of an understanding. But for me, it's like, you know, continuing to be open to learn more about it. Exactly. And really, it's crazy. Like I said, it's like, how can you expect to reduce a narrative from the people that form the largest population of human beings on the planet? So
exactly. And also from us, like, all I want to do is talk about it, and like you said, just educate and discuss with people, as you know, as I've always done. But at the same time, it's not my narrative, so I who am I to speak for anyone that's not a white male? Like, I can't even speak. So all I have to do is just literally, you know, kind of open discussion
and that's the thing, is that, you know, it's been, again, another way of rebuttal has kind of been like, well, people are like, well, am I supposed to be ashamed to be white? No one's supposed to be ashamed of anything at all, because by that it's like, because really that is the real, the larger conversation is that why are we even deriving pride from something we had no control over? So, I mean, in the way that it's like when someone's like, why do we need to have a female-only comedy competition?
Well, we need a black history.
Yeah, we need a black history.
Oh my God.
Why do we need one? But there's a reason why we need that. Obviously, everyone knows there's a reason why you need that, because it's something that's been obscured from the from human history. So we understand why. So for me, I'm not trying to evoke any feelings of shame and stuff, because I feel when I watch someone, a comedian like Bill Burr, you know, this shame, trying to bring shame of being a white man, can go. And for me, I don't feel offended when he talks about that, because I'm getting a real human perspective from someone that's, you know, being pensive, and he's actually, you know, he's pondering his existence as a white man, and that's fine. And for me, that is a lot more constructive. And even in some places where he's like, well, you know, well, when guys like, well, if I was you, I could be fly doing this and that. He's like, it's not as easy as you make out. But that is genuine, and I appreciate it a lot more than someone who's oblivious and like, I don't know what everyone's talking about. I find the obliviousness almost more offensive, especially in the medium of like creativity, than people that might discuss stuff which may be considered slightly offensive, or because I prefer someone's working through it, and they're working through their moves, yeah, and they're trying to, and they're trying to rationalize and understand something, and yeah, they, and they're actually maybe expressing their own failings, their own flaws, and understanding kind of racial politics. And yeah, I appreciate a lot more than people that just act like the conversation doesn't exist, or, you know, I don't see colour and blah blah blah. Then, well, how the fuck are you an observational comedian? Because that's the first thing you can see about people.
How important, Danny, was it to put this into the writing for Time Wasters? Because, you know, you had a lot, you know, there was, you dealt with the topic very subtly in places, and also not so subtly in others. But, like, you know, how important was this to kind of, like, get it into the writing?
So I wouldn't say it was necessarily important, but I had great fun in putting it in there and playing with those things and having people gasp and shock and, like, question things and see how society works when it comes to race, because it's very rarely represented on screen, but from, like, a black perspective, yeah, which is quite nice. I like the fact that we were black characters going into this white world and we get to see it through our eyes,
yeah,
as, because you never get to see that. You always get to see, when black characters come into a world, you see it through white eyes,
yeah,
and how it affects all these white people. But so it was just quite fun to kind of play around with and have a mess about, and I think people have appreciated it,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
just having a different perspective.
And I think the perspective thing is the biggest part, is that, you know, you're dealing with archetypes that are very different to the conventional, you know, black archetype, and that's and that's only, that can only be more useful. And I think a lot of time people definitely underestimate how much media is involved in shaping, you know, the perspective of, I mean, it's black people especially, where, you know, the diaspora really based in what, Western Europe maybe, and then, you know, in the Americas. For people outside of that, if people live in, like, Australasia or in Asia and stuff, then they form their perspective of black people based on media and what they see, because
yeah,
they're not interacting with them on a regular basis. So if that is quite negative, then it means the outlook in the world is going to be affected, yeah, by that as well. And, you know, obviously hip hop has largely been one of the biggest kind of, I guess, one of the biggest phenomena to, like, you know, show the black experience. But if that becomes skewed, then it can be quite worrying if people aren't, because a lot of time people don't necessarily practically go and search for alternate sources or for alternate, like, mouthpieces so far as experience. So it's, yeah, there's only so much you can do so far as TV, so the more varied you can show,
yeah,
the better. So and the same thing with, like, Sunny D as well, is that, you know, I there didn't need to be, like, there were certain, you know, there's certain trigger words and certain situations where, you know, there aren't going to be any chicken references here, or there aren't going to be any roadman references here. Number one, because it's not my experience, and also because I feel like it's massively fucking saturated. Like,
yeah,
we're not deprived of, like, seeing that facet of, like, the black experience in the UK. So
yeah,
I definitely want to do something different as well. And also, in my 30s, man, I don't want to play a fucking, pretend to be a child and be a fucking roadman, because I'm an adult. And
I've seen plenty of white comedians do that.
Yeah,
like middle class, upper class white comedians, that it kills me, man. Like, I won't name names, but you know, there's exactly, a lot of them, and they, you know, I hope that the next wave of people getting called out is them for like classism,
and appropriation to an extent, or misappropriation, and I think it will happen, and that's, it's a big part of net neutrality, is that so many other voices can kind of be involved. And what happens, unfortunately, like, I was reading this story about, like, Logan Sama today.
Yeah, I saw that.
Where, like, sometimes it's like familiarity breeds contempt.
Yeah.
And if you're around a certain situation, and some people do feel like they can contribute to that narrative, and you should never kind of make that mistake and think, because you're around certain people, that you can talk the way they do, because it's not the same situation for you.
All right, well, I think that's got to the end of the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 19. Unless you want to add anything, do you want to promo anything? You're writing season 2, and you're touring, so let's start with the touring first.
The tour of my show Gold, Oil and Drugs, or God, starts in 2018. So look out for dates on danebaptiste.co.uk. Currently have a Netflix special, Live at the BBC, so check out Live at the BBC and watch that as well. And
how have I not seen that? I
didn't know. Because it's under Live at the BBC, so if you search Live at the BBC, okay, comedy, cool, you'll find my episode there as well. So holy, check that
shit,
out.
Sick.
Okay. Very cool. And then check out Sunny D, which should be online by now. Yeah, and
I mean, Time Wasters season 2 being written.
I'm writing it. If it's going to be on TV is another question.
Petition your TV station.
Keep
watching it on the ITV player.
And then send abuse at ITV2.
Any stand-up things coming up that you actually, is there anything?
No. So this is pretty much my life now. Focused. So I literally, they literally have a dungeon that I write in. So I go into the dungeon and like just hide away for several months.
Or in a Netflix dungeon.
Apparently. Or in a I mean, there's those, they're not dungeons. Those are palaces. They got money. Nice. So hopefully,
what's the case of like a Netflix?
So basically Netflix just gives money to a production company and then they treat us.
Good catering.
Well, yeah, one of the writers' rooms was in the Groucho, so
holy shit.
I know. That's how they roll. That's how they roll.
Holy shit. Alright, so make sure you go and watch Time Wasters right now. Thank you so much, Dane and Dan.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 19. Thank you to the special guests, Dane Baptiste and Daniel Taylor. Make sure you go watch Time Wasters. It's on the ITV2 player right now. Make sure you go catch Dane on tour next year. It's going to be fucking sick. And go watch his Netflix special, which I didn't even know existed until this show. So I'm going to go watch it right now. And make sure you go stream and download my brand new album, This Is Where It Gets Good, which is out now. Thank you once again for the continued downloads. I'll see you lot in December. Big up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.